You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, how you see things. You know how sometimes you look for something, you can't find it, and then you discover that it was staring you right in the face all the time, sort of hidden in plain sight? Well, writing in the journal Nature, researchers report that you're a lot more likely to make a mistake looking for a rare object than when you're looking for something that you see often. Joining me now to talk about the work is Jeremy Wolfe. He's professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Med School and one of the authors of that study. And he joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
You did a very interesting experiment. Walk us through it. Describe how the experiment was set up and the results that you got.
Well, what we did was we had subjects doing a sort of a laboratory version of the screening task that you'd do at the airport when your bag's going through the X-ray screener. So we had subjects looking for, well, they were looking for tools, and we had them looking for a tool on a screen that was cluttered up with a bunch of other objects, not necessarily objects that you would find in a regular suitcase. We had owls and penguins and a few other odd things in there.
Waldo?
Well, yes, it's Where's Waldo isn't a bad example, only our pictures are much uglier. But what we had subjects do was to push one button if they found a tool and another button if the fake bag didn't contain a tool. And when we had them do this in a block of trials where the tool was present half the time, so on half the trials there was a tool, on half the trials they were supposed to say no, well, if they did that, they missed about 7% of the tools. But that's not what's going on out there in the real world of baggage screening or medical screening for in radiology or something of that sort. There, the targets are much rarer. So we ran the same study with much rarer tools, and the tools only showed up 1% of the time. If you do that, you have to run thousands and thousands of trials. But when we did that, the error rates went up from about 7% to about 30%. Now, we don't know if that happens out there in the world, but it's a troubling sort of a finding, given that we have people doing a lot of these sorts of rare target or low prevalence search tasks in situations that we consider to be very important, like security at airports.
Let me just repeat what you were saying. In other words, when a rare tool came through, people sort of missed it.
Well, these were the same tools.
Yeah, but if it
was only appearing very rarely,
right,
then they were more likely to miss it.
And that you are right, because we would expect the screeners hopefully will only see these rare things coming through.
Right. I mean, that's what we have them doing. We want them to find the rare threat that's showing up in your bag, or we want them to find the rare tumor that's showing up in a routine mammogram. And we may be built by nature to do search tasks for targets that aren't spectacularly rare. The mechanisms that control your ability to do visual search were probably designed by nature to help you find raspberries on raspberry bushes or friends in groups of people, not to look for things that only show up one time in 100 or one time in 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what's going on in the brain, why there are differences here?
We don't know what's going on in the brain at a neural level. What we do know is that we think we know where the problem lies. The problem is, when do you know that it's time to quit searching? If you find what you're looking for, so if you found a tool, or if you're at the airport and you find a knife in somebody's bag, that's no trick. You know that it's time to quit. But if there's nothing there, when do you quit? You can't search forever. The line would get too long at the airport. So you've got to quit at some point. How do you decide when it's time to quit? You end up setting a criterion in your mind that says, I've searched long enough. And that criterion is based on the success that you've had to that point. Right. And if you're doing a search where there are targets some of the time and not there some of the time, you can calibrate yourself pretty well. But if the targets are very, very rare, well, you can see part of the problem. If you imagine that you could be 99% successful if you closed your eyes and just said no all of the time. Mm-hmm. And the chunks of your brain that are working on setting that quitting criterion and that quitting threshold are being driven into a bad place. They're being driven to say no much too quickly. Mm-hmm. In fact, what we found in the experiment is that typically in these sort of tasks, the time it takes you on average to say yes, yes, there is something there, is less than the time it takes you to say no. That makes sense. You wait around a little while to make sure you didn't miss it. When the targets were very rare, people were saying no in an average amount of time that was faster than the amount of time it, it takes to say yes, and that's not going to be good.
Well, if the baggage screeners read your paper, is there something that they can do to, you know, to up the chances that something rare might be found?
There are a number of things that one might want to try. For example, one of the things that the radiologists do in many cases, and I think actually has been tried at some baggage screening centers, is to have two people look at the bags. If you imagine that these are essentially independent, random sort of mistakes that people are making, if one person has a 30% chance of missing a target, two people operating independently would have a 30% times 30% chance, and that's only 9%, and so they'd do much better. That would be one possible way that you might want to deal with it. Of course, you're going to need an extra person
right
at that point.
Right. What about, you know, putting phony little pictures in there so that you increase the rate that somebody finds something so that they'll find the real object?
Well, in fact, that's the airport people already do that. That machine that you put your suitcase through on the way through the check-in gate has the ability to project into your bag a gun, bomb, or knife. And if the screener finds it, a little message comes up and says, "Congratulations, you found one of our fake ones. Now go and check whether he's carrying something bad for real." But that way they can keep an eye on how well screeners are doing. At the present time, those are still very rare targets, because if you start putting in false targets on every trial or on 50% of the trials, again, you'd slow things down quite a bit. That might not be the most straightforward solution. Plus, it's a very difficult task at the airport. One of the problems is that the machine puts in threats that they've found before. And if you train people, for example, to see guns and knives, and the next thing turns out to be something that we haven't thought of yet, we may actually make it more difficult for them to find it by, in effect, directing their attention to the wrong object.
Interesting. 1-800-989-8255. Jack in Berkeley. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Hi. I think you've now covered this. Of course, the problem of finding something completely novel, unique, that hasn't been thought of before, how will they even be able to recognize it? But my earlier comment was really that I guess in the case of screeners, you train and train and train them so that certain objects for them are no longer rare, but in fact common, even though for the rest of us they might be rare. And maybe that's kind of simplistic, but that's just what I was thinking at the time.
Oh, the rareness here is not rare in the sense of something that's unusual and hard to recognize, though that's a problem in its own right. This is the case of if you take a perfectly fine, recognizable object. So in our experiments, for example, a pair of pliers or a screwdriver, everybody knows what that looks like. The rareness is that it only shows up on one out of every 100 screens that we show you. And that turns out to be the problem. Our subjects have no trouble recognizing the items when we show them. It's that when they're rare, you end up quitting your search too quickly. You're convinced that it's just not going to be there.
Is there a time factor here where you get tired, you know, after 5, 10 minutes, an hour, where, you know, you're pretty fresh at the first 15 minutes and you find things, and after a while you're getting to miss those rare objects, and maybe the answer is just to recycle people through a little faster?
The airport does that, and we did that too. We only had people searching for about 20 minutes at a time. Certainly, if you were to put somebody on a search task for hours at a time, you run into fatigue problems that would make matters even worse. But in this case, it's probably not fatigue that's the problem, because, you know, after 20 minutes, you get up and wander around. It's boring. That may be a problem.
Yeah.
But it's we're not torturing them too badly.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Morgan in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there. Have you got a solution for this?
Well, no, I just had a point to make that I used to work on airplanes for the United States Air Force, and when we would have problems where, say, a pilot had lost an object into the cockpit of a plane, we'd have to rip the cockpit apart and then conduct searches. And, of course, 90% of the times, we wouldn't know what the object was or how he lost it because of communication failure. But the point I wanted to make is that we would put several different eyes on it. Say one person searched for a short amount of time, and I guess you just said that the more people that you put against the search, the more likely you are to find the object.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And another possibility is that what you want to do is to have specialists. One of my colleagues, Kyle Cave at UMass, is interested in the possibility that what you really want to do is have one person looking at this bag for, say, guns and another one looking for knives so that you'd increase your chance of finding it because you were a specialist in this particular case.
What about having the computer help you out a bit, so, you know, getting its recognition software a little, you know, better so it finds the things and the people just help out verifying them?
That's certainly an active area of work. The trick, if you have people just verifying, is that you'd better be sure that the computer is finding everything of interest. This was a problem in radiology in the sort of first generation of computer-assisted efforts to find tumors, where the computer would say, I think you ought to look at locations A, B, and C. And if the tumor was in locations A, B, and C, great, it helped you out. But if the computer missed it, you were more likely to miss a tumor in location D because the computer hadn't
right.
flagged it. You have to end up working carefully with the computer. Plus, we don't have a computer that can do bag search yet very well.
Yeah. Talking
it's a very
with
tricky problem.
Oh, yes. We're talking with Jeremy Wolf, professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Med School in Boston. I'm Ira Flato, and this is Science Friday and NPR News. What about that? I'm more concerned, you know, we have baggage handlers. I'm more concerned about the issue you talked about with radiology, where if you have a breast cancer, some sort of tumor that shows up on radiation, that you might miss it. Do you have doctors that just sit there and look at slide after slide, you know, x-ray after x-ray, and much the same way as baggage handlers do to looking for knives and guns?
I think that it's a little bit of a different sort of a structure of the task. Often they're being sent x-rays with instructions to go and look at something specific. So they're given more instruction in many cases if you're in a pathology lab. But there are professions, I gather, where it is very much like the baggage screening case. So, for example, my understanding is that at least in England, there are there's a profession of cytologists whose job it is basically to look at pap smears, and the job is to look at one after another and find the ones that have abnormal cells in them and flag them. So this, at least in the sort of abstract sense that we're thinking about the problems are really very similar.
Yeah, so then you would ask another, you'd get a second opinion on all the slides then if you wanted to have a little bit.
Well, that's certainly one way of approaching it would be to make sure that you get two eyeballs on the, I suppose it would be four eyeballs on the same slide.
But do we have any data that shows that that would actually improve things? I mean, if this second person is also getting tired of looking at stuff, how do we know? You know, logically it says it would happen, but would it make a really significant dent?
The radiologists think it does. They have data that says that having two eyes cuts down on the number of errors versus having only a single observer.
So what do you say to all these screeners? What is the take-home message from your research?
Well, I think the take-home message from everything that I learn about the baggage screening task, for example, is that it's a very difficult task, that there are lots of pieces of it that make it difficult. This would just be one possible contributing factor, which might be pushing people towards more errors. And I suppose the take-home message is, let's go and try a few things that might make your life a little bit easier, whether it's a different style of training or having an extra pair of eyes looking at the screen. That we should appreciate how difficult it is to actually find threats in bags, or for that matter, tumors in mammograms, and work to make it easier.
David in Baton Rouge, quickly.
Yes, hi. I had a question about, you've addressed sort of about specialists. And my question is whether your experiment looked at the effective training of an individual to identify the rare object and to do it more often. So it may be rare in the material they're looking at, but it's common in their experience. Do you have any...
That's the experiment for next year, or one of the experiments for next year. It's certainly the case that training is important. We got around that by using common objects like screwdrivers. But if you or I took a look at a mammogram, even if the radiologist told you there was a tumor there, you wouldn't know where it was because you wouldn't know what to look for. So training people on these very difficult search tasks is a critical piece of the job.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us. We've run out of time.
My pleasure.
This is Dr. Jeremy Wolf. He's professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Med School in Boston, and we're talking about how to search better, how to use your eyes better. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Manoli Weatherall and Neil Rausch in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We make free teaching material. If you click on the teachers button, you'll get this free teaching stuff that you can download to use in your classrooms. Also, we're podcasting Science Friday. You can podcast now or download on Real Audio or your Audible player to your iPod. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.